This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Grilling and barbecuing used to be synonymous with the hot dogs, hamburger, steaks, and chicken you'd make at a picnic or in the backyard. But now home cooks and gourmet chefs are grilling all kinds of foods. Practically every country has its own grilled dishes. My guest, Stephen Reichlin, wanted to sample as many as he could. His new cookbook is called The Barbecue Bible. For his research, he ate his way across 150,000 miles, covering 25 countries over five continents. Reichlin is also the author of the high-flavor, low-fat cookbook series. He says grilling is not only the oldest and most widespread method of cooking, it's also the most forgiving, but there's still an art to it.
Barbecuing and grilling are arts in the sense that you're never working with the same fire twice. A fire is always different. It will cook differently. You can always slow the cooking process down by moving the food away from the fire. Whenever I build a fire, I always leave part of the grate without fire. Actually, I build a tapered fire. I call it a two-tiered fire. So you can move the food back and forth. You can always buy yourself time. Whereas with something like deep fat frying or with baking, anything you do in a kitchen, I think requires more precision.
Tell me more about how you build your two-tiered fire.
Well, I use a chimney starter. Ideally, my favorite fuel to cook over is wood. And this is something people don't realize, but you can buy hardwood chunks almost at any large hardware store and light the chunks the same way you would light charcoal. Now, let's assume most people are going to be more familiar with charcoal. Here, too, there are different gradations. My favorite type of charcoal is called char wood, and that is whole logs that are cooked in a kiln. If you look at it, it looks very tree-like. You can see the rings. And this is a much cleaner, purer product than, let's say, briquettes, which may contain coal dust or paraffin or petroleum binders or starters. Any case, so chimney starter looks like a coffee can with the top and bottom cut out. Some sort of ignition at the bottom could be crumpled up. Newspaper could be a little paraffin fire starter. The char wood or charcoal in the top. And basically, you light it and come back 15 minutes later, and that cylindrical shape enables all the coals to light evenly, and you get a beautiful glowing mass of coals, which you then dump out into your grill. Now, to set up the grill, if you can imagine a sloping layer of coals, on one side of the grill, the coals will be a double layer of thickness. On the other side, the coals will be a single layer of thickness, and I actually leave about maybe a quarter or fifth of the grill with no coals at all. So I've got three heats. I've got a high heat, medium heat, and low heat, and I can achieve either one simply by moving the food back and forth. Gas grill, it's easier, right? On a gas grill, you simply raise or lower the burners. Actually, for a gas grill, I do build a high fire on one side and then a medium heat on the other side, and I like to move the food back and forth.
You know those little pieces of wood that you described that you could buy instead of the briquettes?
Yeah.
Will they give a nice smoking quality?
They will give a wonderful
smoky flavor.
Yeah, a wonderful smoky flavor. And it's important to make a distinction. Now, a lot of people are familiar with using wood chips, which you soak and you toss on your charcoals or your briquettes. This is different. These are actually chunks of wood that you cook over. There's a common misconception, that is that charcoal gives a flavor. There's not a charcoal flavor. There's a charred flavor that comes from cooking over charcoal. But if you want a wood or smoky flavor, you really have to use wood or wood chips.
What's the difference between grilling and barbecuing?
Great question. Very simply, grilling is a direct high heat method done in a very brief amount of time with a small piece of meat. High heat, the flames are right under what you're going to cook. It's usually a steak or a chicken breast or a fish fillet or a vegetable. Time period, rarely more than 20 minutes will you grill something. Barbecuing, on the other hand, is a long, slow, indirect method. The heat source is located away from the food. The cooking time is measured in hours rather than minutes. If you start to get into some of the American styles of barbecuing, a Texas brisket at Sonny Bryant's in Dallas might be cooked for 12 to 14 hours. Smoke is very important in barbecuing. There's always a smoking component. Barbecue is really designed to cook large cuts of meat and tough cuts of meat, and it's the slow, long cooking that tenderizes those cuts.
Let's talk about just some of the cooking principles that are helpful to keep in mind when you're grilling, like the importance of preheating the grill.
Mm. That's actually commandment number 3 in the 10 commandments of barbecuing and grilling. People, you need a high heat to start with to get the sear and the char that really give you the characteristic grilled flavor. And a lot of people start with too low a heat. You won't get handsome grill marks if you start with too low a heat. You won't get the searing and charring that really give you the grilled flavor.
So how long do you preheat?
Well, if I'm working over charcoal, let's say it takes 15 to 20 minutes to light the coals in the chimney starter, and then I would spread out the coals and maybe leave the grate on for another 5 minutes. The idea here being that you want to get the grate very hot before you brush it with a wire brush to clean it. That gives you a good clean, and then when you oil the grate and you put the food on, you'll get nice grill marks. And grill marks are really the they're really the trademark maybe of an expert griller. It's that handsome crosshatch of grill marks that you're looking for.
And you say don't stab the food. Make sure you're turning it with a spatula or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, unless you want to deliberately drain out the juices into the coals instead of down your gullet. I don't know why companies actually manufacture barbecue forks. The idea here, you're cooking a steak. If you stab it, the juices run out. If you turn it with tongs, you keep the juices inside.
Know when to baste. Well, when do you baste?
Well, first thing to know is when not to baste. In the United States, we are very partial to a sweet tomato-based barbecue sauce, and that really should go on at the end of cooking. Anything that contains sugar should be applied the last 5 to 10 minutes. Now, if you're working with a melted butter or olive oil or yogurt-based or wine-based basting mixture, those can go on earlier. But anything that contains a lot of sugar will burn, so you want to put it on at the end.
And you say give it a rest when it's done cooking.
Yeah, this is the easiest thing that you can do to make good-tasting barbecue taste great. If you're cooking a steak or chicken or fish, let it sit for a few minutes before you serve it. Now, why is that? When you cook over a direct high heat, as in grilling, the heat drives the meat juices to the center of whatever you're cooking, your steak, your chop. If you serve it right away, when you cut into it, the outside of that steak will be dry because the juices haven't had a chance to be reabsorbed by the meat tissue. If you let it sit for 2 or 3 minutes, the juices will come back to the edge and you have a much juicier piece of meat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Reichlin, and he's the author of the new book, The Barbecue Bible. You travel through what you described as the barbecue belt, which is basically around the globe, and you travel to lots of countries here, there, and yonder that grill their food. So give us a sense of your map, your barbecue map.
Well, the barbecue trail circumnavigates the globe. It primarily stays between the Tropic of Capricorn and Cancer. That is, it's primarily a tropical phenomenon, which makes sense because you think people who live in the tropics spend more time outdoors, cook outdoors. But there are a few really important exceptions, like Argentina, for example, or like North America, where there's a lot of grilling, or like Japan and Korea, which were freezing when I visited them, but, you know, grilling was very popular. And in fact, grilling is a way in those countries for people to warm up in the winter. So that's basically the barbecue trail. I started in Jamaica, which is the home of Jamaican jerk, and that is probably closest to a dish the Arawak Indians called barbacoa, or at least to the Spanish ears, the ears of the Spanish explorers. It sounded like barbacoa. A barbacoa was a wooden frame, a wooden grid over which meats were smoke cooked, and of course it gave us our word barbecue. So I wanted to start there because I felt like that was probably the closest, birthplace of one type of barbecue.
Well, Jamaican jerk or Jamaican barbecue is catching on in the States. Tell us more about their technique.
Well, first of all, I mean, there's the jerk. First of all, there's the word jerk, which comes from a patois word to juke, which means to stab something or someone with a sharp implement. And the idea here was that first you would juke the pig twice. You'd kill it by stabbing it, and then you'd poke little holes in the meat all over with a sharp implement, and you would rub the jerk seasoning into the meat. Now, the jerk seasoning is a fiery paste made of as many as 2 dozen ingredients, Scotch bonnet chili for heat, native Caribbean thyme for aroma, the allspice berry, which is very important and is much stronger, the Jamaican version, than the North American version. You have cinnamon, you have soy sauce, you have oil, a lot of different ingredients. And it's very salty. And, you know, most people have had jerk in North America, but I found when I visited Boston Beach, which is the birthplace of jerk, that, you know, you really find things out that you don't know from eating it in North America. One is how salty the marinade is, for example. I mean, you know, as a cookbook author, I was a little nervous putting the authentic amount of salt in the recipe, but it's really quite a bit. Now, the next thing that makes jerk so unique is that it's cooked over a fire made with allspice wood. And not only that, but in Boston Beach, they actually, instead of using a metal grate, they use sticks of allspice wood. Those sticks catch fire during the process of the 3 or 4 hours it takes to cook a jerk pork. So the pitmaster is periodically replacing the bars of his grate because they're burning. And that's one reason why Jamaican jerk is so extraordinary, and another reason why it would be difficult to exactly reproduce it at home.
Yeah, I can imagine. as you point out, you know, in America, the idea of barbecue is so associated with, you know, hamburgers and hot dogs and slabs of steak. It's a real, like, carnivore's delight. And if you're a vegetarian at a barbecue, you're considered a real, like, killjoy. Or if you just like to have little portions of meat with lots of vegetables, you're considered, you know, really out of place at a barbecue. Whereas in many of the places you travel to, such as Thailand and Vietnam, the whole idea of grilling is really different than here, and the proportion of meat to everything else is really different too. Tell us about some of your experiences in Thailand and what was served there.
Well, that was a really wonderful antidote to the sort of belly-bludgeoning, belt-loosening portions of meat that are served at North American barbecues. And I mean, I like North American barbecue as much as the next guy. But in Thailand, I have a recipe that's called lettuce bundles with lemongrass grilled beef from Thailand. Now, in Thailand, we might sit down to an 8-ounce sirloin steak. In Thailand, that steak would serve 4 people instead of one person. It would be marinated in a paste of lemongrass, garlic, shallot, fish sauce, so you could use soy sauce, lime juice, and sugar. So you do have the sweet and salty that you have in the West, but with a much more aromatic and exotic flavor. The beef is then cut into very thin strips and grilled, and it's served with a platter of, let's see, you get a lettuce leaf, you get sprigs of fresh mint, you get sprigs of Thai basil, you might get bean sprouts, you might get steamed or boiled rice noodles, which are all kind of bundled up, almost taco or mushu style, together with the meat. So you take a bite, you get this explosive flavor of the lemongrass marinated meat, but you're also eating your vegetables and your starches.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Reichlin. His new book is called The Barbecue Bible. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Reichlin, and he traveled the globe sampling grilled and barbecued food around the world, and he's written a new book called The Barbecue Bible. That's about his adventures and lots of recipes. A lot of the barbecue that you ate in your journey around the barbecue belt covering the world was food from street vendors. Mm. And as you point out, street vendor food can be really delicious, but you never know if it's very sanitary. People aren't necessarily washing their hands, and they're handling a lot of different things. And the running water, if there is any, might not be very clean. So what kind of standards do you use when you're eating grilled food or any food from street vendors in faraway places?
Well, you know, all I can say is that I was lucky I was writing a book on grilling and not global salads, because I probably wouldn't be here to tell you about it now. But in general, I feel like grilled food would come off hot off the grill. And so it was probably sanitized when it came off the grill. Now, in many parts of the world, like India, then the kebabi man very obligingly takes the meat off the skewer for you with his bare hands. So that kind of raises another level of challenge. I would avoid, in Vietnam, I tried to avoid eating the accompanying lettuce and mint leaves sometimes, but I pretty much went for it. And I had one experience in Thailand. I was taken to an Isarn restaurant. Now, the Isarn are the people on the Laotian border, and they're the kind of poorest members of Thai society, and they do a lot of grilling in Bangkok. And I was taken to an Isarn neighborhood that it really was like a scene in the jungle. I mean, dogs lying in the streets and babies being washed on the sidewalks, and, you know, this in the middle of Bangkok. And I was taken to a restaurant that had a dirt floor, and I was the guest of honor. They even turned on the air conditioning for me. I mean, it was extraordinary. And I happened to wander into the kitchen, and this was a windowless kitchen that overlooked a stagnant canal with dead animals in it. And it was really, it was a scene, it was a hygiene that probably hasn't been seen in Europe since the Middle Ages. And I thought, I'm never going to make it through this meal without getting sick. But because they had gone to such trouble for me, I ate everything, and I ate it with gusto, and I didn't get sick. I mean, nobody was more surprised than I was at that point.
Although we associate grilling and barbecuing most with meat, grilled vegetables can be very good. And you have a whole chapter on grilled vegetables. Were there places around the world that seem to specialize in grilled vegetables?
Absolutely. And that was one of the most important reasons that I went to India, because India has a huge vegetarian population. What I didn't know is to what extent Indian grill chefs go to accommodate their vegetarian clients. There's a kebab called a Sikh kebab, and basically, traditionally, it's a ground meat kebab, and instead of forcing the ground meat into a sausage casing to make a sausage, they mold it onto a flat skewer to make sort of a skinless sausage. Well, at the Sheraton Rajputana Hotel in Jaipur, which has a very big vegetarian clientele, they had come up with all sorts of interesting Sikh kebabs made with roasted yams, made with pureed cheese, made with spinach, flavored with yellow raisins for sweetness and almonds and cashews for nuttiness, bell peppers that are stuffed with cabbage and cheese and vegetable mixtures, and then impaled on a vertical spit and cooked on in a tandoor, an Indian barbecue pit. But India wasn't the only country. Japan has an incredible tradition of grilled vegetables and grilled tofu. And you visit any of the shrines or temples in Tokyo, and there will be stalls outside serving grilled rice cakes that are brushed with teriyaki sauce or umeboshi plum sauce. You'll find grilled vegetables of all sorts. There was an incredible restaurant in Tokyo called Inakaya, which is a very expensive and very theatrical grill restaurant. And they have, it almost looks like walking into a market. There's a huge bar with perhaps 20 different types of vegetables arrayed out in baskets. And you point, I want some okra, I want some some taro, I want some baby bell peppers. And those will be grilled, perhaps with a brushing of sesame oil and a sprinkling of salt, nothing more. But they are so extraordinarily flavorful.
What tips would you give us on grilling vegetables here in the States? What vegetables are tastiest when grilled, and which should we not bother to try?
Well, the best vegetables for grilling are those with a high water content. Your bell peppers, endive, vegetables like asparagus. Okra is absolutely delicious grilled. It's the best way I know to make okra is by grilling. In terms of flavoring, keep it real simple. You know, a brushing of extra virgin olive oil or sesame oil, which I like, a sprinkle of salt and pepper, maybe a squeeze of lemon juice, work over a high heat. Almost everything tastes better grilled, but there is no better way to cook vegetables than grilling. Of this, I'm convinced. The only vegetables that don't work well on the grill are kind of hard, starchy vegetables, beets, potatoes. They can be grilled, but you need to use the indirect method or bury the vegetables in coals.
Steve Reichlin is my guest, and he's the author of the new book, The Barbecue Bible. I'm interested in hearing more about your adventures on the road. Let's just start with the basics of health. You know, people don't want to get traveler's disease when they're on the road. You're eating for a living. Mm. What kind of pills and remedies do you take with you in case you eat the wrong thing?
Well, I take Pepto-Bismol. I took, I think it was Lomotil or, you know, one of those anti-diarrheal medicines. And that was pretty much it. First of all, you are going to get sick. You know, that's kind of part of the reality of being a food writer and traveling. And when you go to countries like India and Vietnam, you know, you try and exercise caution in terms of not eating lettuce. This is a terrible thing to tell you, but when I was in India, sometimes I would taste things, and then when people weren't looking, I would spit them out. I mean, so I could kind of capture and memorize the flavor, but not put myself at undue peril.
Why not the lettuce leaves? Why are you singling that out?
Well, because often lettuce leaves are, always lettuce leaves are washed in local water, and that's just as bad as drinking local water. I mean, and, you know, I saw some pretty creepy things in Vietnam, for example. I was eating at a restaurant and I happened to see the ice delivery, and they just pick up a block of ice with tongs and set it down in the gutter. Well, if you're the person, you know, getting your icy drink made from the top of the ice cube, you're fine. But, you know, if you're getting the bottom of the ice cube, wow.
Did you travel with hand wipes so that you could eat it under these circumstances?
Nah, I didn't. You know, this will sound extremely strange and extremely unscientific, but I think that there's a goodwill factor that you can bring to eating and hygiene. And I was so thrilled, so many of the places I was, to be eating what I was and being shown what I was seeing, that I think maybe someone sort of that didn't have that kind of attitude of enthusiasm and
would
love
have succumbed.
Might have gotten sick more than I did.
Well, Stephen Reichlin, thank you very much for talking with us.
This was really fun, Terry.
Stephen Reichlin's new book is called The Barbecue Bible. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.